Désolé pour ce petit retard technique. Voilà, c'est la technologie. On va commencer cette conférence peut-être par découvrir un petit peu qui est Mike Carey. Et puis après, on va s'intéresser à ce qu'il a fait et en bande dessinée et en roman. Mais je voulais revenir peut-être sur les débuts. Quand est-ce que vous avez commencé à découvrir un peu tout ce qui est science-fiction imaginaire? Et puis, quels sont les auteurs que vous aimiez? Comment tout cela s'est fait pour vous?
Right. I got the habit through a British writer called Enid Blyton. And she doesn't write science fiction, she writes fantasy, or wrote fantasy for a lot of the first half of the 20th century. The Faraway Tree stories, the Wishing Chair stories, lots and lots of stories about little kids discovering a magical world. And it was, you know, it was like crack to me. It really sort of, it really spoke to me. And I think that was how I got hooked on fantastic literature. And then after that, I discovered American superhero comic books, particularly the work of Stan Lee and Jack Kirby on Fantastic Four, which is, you know, more than halfway to being science fiction already. And I discovered the prose literature much later through writers like Michael Moorcock, Roger Zelazny, Mervyn Peake.
C'était des influences plutôt littéraires ou il y avait aussi du cinéma, du comics?
Not so much film, because we were pretty poor, and I didn't go to the cinema very much. But there was quite a lot of science fiction on TV in Britain in the 60s. Very, very low budget stuff, like obviously Doctor Who, which was a staple of my childhood, but also series like The Tomorrow People, which was about children discovering that they're mutants. It was kind of like a British version of the X-Men. There was a thing called Time Slip, which is about two children discovering a little hole in the fabric of space and time and crawling through it to the into the past and into different alternative futures. So yeah, it's TV rather than movies. And yeah, to a large extent, the literature as I got older. Books were very expensive. We still have it here in France. We used to have a thing called the Netbook Agreement, which was a guarantee that you could not sell books at discount. So books were very expensive items for me as a child, but there were cheap mass-market paperbacks. Companies like New English Library and Mayflower were bringing out paperback books for a few shillings, and most of Michael Moorcock's work was available like that. E.E. Doc Smith, the American science fiction writer with the dodgy right-wing political views, Cordwainer Smith. So I was sort of walking from newsagent to newsagent, not bookshops. Newsagents, tabac, would sell these things, and I would just sort of pick them up in vast quantities.
Et comment est-ce que vous en êtes venu à écrire à partir de ce pot culturel?
I can't remember because it's too far back. I always told stories. Every time I had a prose assignment in school, I would use the excuse to write a science fiction story. And my teachers used to get really angry because that was all I ever wrote. Just endless sci-fi and fantasy, whatever the assignment was, whatever I was supposed to be doing. And then as I got older, I started to write. I mean, I used to write novels, or things that I called novels. I wrote them in stolen school exercise books, and I just write exercise book after exercise book of these things, which were big, shapeless bags of story. I never really knew where they were going. And as I got a little older, I started to do journalism. I started to do reviews and articles about comics for amateur magazines. And I did that for many years. And then a guy I know became an editor on a comic book line. It didn't last for very long. It lasted like a year and a half before they went bankrupt. But I started submitting scripts to him. And so I broke in through comics. Before that, I had submitted novels to publishers. And they'd always been rejected. They'd been rejected basically because they had no shape. They had no form whatsoever. They were just these screeds of story that meandered endlessly. So comics kind of taught me the discipline of structuring a story.
Alors on arrive justement aux comics, puisque c'est les premières publications pour vous. Comment est-ce que ça s'est fait? Sur quoi vous avez commencé à travailler?
There was a series called Aquarius, which was a superhero series, which I pitched to a very small UK publisher, Apocalypse Press. It was Watchmen. It was based on Watchmen. I just read Watchmen, and the only kind of comic story that I could think of was just do Watchmen again in a different with a different name. So I pitched that and got that approved. And I also pitched at the same time a sort of psychological horror story called The Legions of Hell, Les Légions de l'Enfer, which is about a woman with multiple personality syndrome, dissociative identity disorder, who believes that she is inhabited by all of the demons of hell, that basically hell is inside her mind. And what she does is when she needs to express a particular emotion, like anger, she just allows the demon that has that emotion to take her over. So she's constantly flicking from one extreme emotional state to another. And the story was about her escaping from care, escaping from clinical care, because they were trying to lobotomize her. They were going to chemically remove part of her brain. And that woman was Jill Presto, who later became a character in Lucifer. So although the story was never published, the publisher went bankrupt, I reused the character elsewhere.
Un petit mot sur une série qui nous tient à cœur, hein, c'est Sandman. Comment est-ce que vous en êtes venu à travailler dessus?
That was kind of like the most incredible and undeserved good luck. It's kind of like, you know, you work and you work and you work and you're pushing at the door, and then you get tired and you lean on it and it just falls open. It turns out it was never locked. I'd been working at that time for about 10 years. For small press publishers, for Apocalypse Press, for Toxic in the UK, for Malibu and Caliber in America. So I'd done all of this small press work, and I would send, every time I got a comic book out, I wasn't getting paid for this stuff. It was just a hobby. But every time I got a book actually published, I would send it to Vertigo, who were the publishers of Sandman, with a begging letter saying, please, please, please let me work for you. And eventually I got a letter back from Alisa Quitney, who was the editor on Sandman, and she told me they were starting up a small series of mini-series, Sandman Presents. And she said, we need somebody to do Sandman Presents Lucifer, but we need it now. We need it right now. There's no time to mess about. We need a pitch in 3 days' time, and we need a script a week after that. Because apparently they'd already commissioned a writer, and she'd let them down for some reason, possibly illness. So they just needed somebody to like pick it up and run with it. And I said, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And so it was like after years and years of struggle, it was just given to me.
Comment est-ce qu'on s'approprie un peu l'univers de Sandman et de Neil Gaiman?
I think I was living in that universe at the time. So Sandman was it was the only book that was being put out at that time that was doing that particular form of storytelling. I'd never come across it before. I guess Alan Moore in The Swamp Thing had done something a little bit similar. But what Neil Gaiman did in Sandman over the course of 75 issues, it was just one novel. It was a continuous novel. But it was told in the most incredibly modulated form. He would have a chapter of the main story, and then he would have a series of little standalone stories that seemed to be completely independent, but they weren't. They actually fed back into the main story in clever and subtle ways, sometimes immediately, sometimes years later. So he was making this kind of incredible four-dimensional tapestry over the space of 6 years. And it was utterly immersive. I adored that book, and I think it's fair to say that when I started to write Lucifer, I just copied what Neil had done. I just took that structure and used it. It was a revelation.
Comment est-ce qu'on travaille à partir de l'univers de quelqu'un d'autre? Est-ce que c'est facile de se glisser dedans? Est-ce que c'est pas trop impressionnant? Vous voyez, c'est pas un univers que vous avez créé vous. Comment est-ce que vous avez fait?
I think it was easier than you would expect for Sandman. I mean, in a way, it was terrifying because obviously you're following on from this man who is one of the greatest practitioners in the medium and arguably, you know, one of the greatest prose storytellers writing in English today. But on the other hand, he had created a mythology which included all of the existing world mythologies. He'd created a stage where angels from the Judeo-Christian religion could talk to Japanese storm gods or Navajo tribal deities, and it made sense. So it was such a big canvas to paint on. You know, it was very easy to find stories that he hadn't told, because there was, you know, every story he did tell opened up these teasing glimpses of other possibilities. So I guess it was just that. I looked for the negative space. I looked for the stories that hadn't been told that I wanted to read, and I wrote those.
Parlez-nous un petit peu justement de Lucifer. On y vient. Série qui vous tient à cœur. Vous avez continué pendant longtemps.
I don't know. I mean, they're not likely to invite me back, I don't think. There is a new Lucifer book out now, but it's being written by a different writer, Holly Black, because I'm engaged elsewhere. And I'm not writing any monthly ongoing comic books at the moment. I'm mainly writing miniseries, which are things that I can fit in between the novels and the screenplays and so on. I loved Lucifer because I never wrote him as kind of an incarnation of evil. I wrote him as an incarnation of willpower, of the selfless individual will. You know, he's not somebody who is evil for the sake of it. He's just somebody who pursues his own path. And if you get in his way for whatever reason, he will just destroy you without a second thought. And I think that selfishness, that utter solipsism, is fascinating to explore. I think my Lucifer is very similar to Milton's Satan in Paradise Lost, and even more so to Blake's adversary in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, where it's not really about good and evil. It's about how you relate to the world. It's about the energy of the human will and what you use that energy for.
Il y a une autre série que je voudrais aborder dans vos comics, c'est The Unwriter, je le prononce pas très bien, l'histoire d'un garçon qui a perdu son père et qui va passer dans un autre monde pour aller le chercher. Histoire à la fois classique, est-ce que vous pouvez nous donner un petit peu vos influences, puis après comment vous avez travaillé dessus?
There were a lot of things that came together with Unwritten. The main artist on Lucifer over the whole of its run, over all those 6 years, was Peter Gross. He came on board with issue 5 and he stayed for the whole run. And working with him was wonderful. Yeah, he's one of the artists who has actually taught me about storytelling. And we came to the end of Lucifer and we really, really wanted to work together again. And we pitched lots and lots of different ideas to Vertigo. I think we pitched something like 30 different possible stories, and we just kept bouncing off. They weren't interested. And we went away. I did X-Men for some years. Peter did a book called American Jesus with Mark Miller. But then we met up again at San Diego, and Pornsack, who was one of the Vertigo editors at that time, was there too. And the three of us sat down and just talked and talked about possible stories. And I had just read the autobiography of Christopher Milne. You know the Winnie the Pooh stories, Winnie l'Ourson? The little boy from those stories, Christopher Robin? He was a real person. He was the son of the author, A.A. Milne, Christopher Robin Milne. And the stories began as bedtime stories to that boy. And then his father decided at a certain point he would publish the stories, and they became incredibly famous, which meant that Christopher Robin became famous as a fictional character in his father's books, and it almost destroyed his life. It had a terrible effect on his childhood. He was bullied at school. He was a very shy boy, and in those pictures, he almost looks like a girl. He wears a long coat that is almost like a dress. And he was bullied by kids at school who used the books and used the little poems from the books to mock him and taunt him. And he wrote in his autobiography, The Enchanted Places, "I felt as if my father had stolen my childhood from me and left me nothing but the empty fame of being his son." So we kind of thought that was an interesting starting point for a story. A guy who is famous, but famous on somebody else's terms, you know, a fame that he has no control over, has no say in, which I think is kind of it's very much a feature of our times that celebrity can be a blessing or a curse, depending on what sort of what face you're able to put to the world, put out to the world. So we decided to write that story, but instead of Tom's father writing Winnie the Pooh, Tom's father wrote the Harry Potter novels, effectively. So Tom is famous as the boy wizard, and then discovers one day that he can do magic. He can actually do magic. And he has to sort of face the terrifying possibility that he might be the fictional character, that he might not be real at all. He might be absolutely contingent on his father's writing. So it was was the biggest influence, I think. And some things like the golden trumpet came in from Hindu mythology. But really, we decided at a certain point that we would just make it a love letter to all of the stories that we loved growing up, all the stories that shaped our lives. Because ultimately, I think stories do shape your life. Stories are the kind of the skeleton of your imagination. We build ourselves on stories. To a large extent, we are stories. So that was our main theme.
Justement, je voudrais rebondir un petit peu. Voilà une série un peu sur l'enfance. Quel est votre rapport justement à l'enfance? Et quand on est auteur, quand on met en scène et qu'on se sert de l'enfance, quelle part est-ce que vous avez mis de vous-même?
That's a tough question. I agree with. I can't remember who said this, but somebody said that adults are just ruined children, just spoiled children. I think there's a sense in which that's true. As a child, you are emotionally open and you're open to experience in a way that most adults can't get close to. So I do see childhood as kind of a lost paradise. I don't think that's necessarily to do with the innocence of childhood. I think it's just to do with the fact that for children, everything, you as a child, you live in a world that is incredibly vivid and intense, where any experience can just like fill your mind to bursting. And as an adult, looking back on that vividness, you can kind of relive it, can't you? You can kind of remember the things that, as a kid, just blew your mind wide open, and they still have power for you. And I guess one of the challenges as a writer is trying to find that vividness again, trying to find a way back to that intensity of experience.
En même temps, vous parlez de paradis perdu, mais que ce soit dans cette série-là ou dans celle qui a tous les dons, vos enfants, à vous, en tant qu'écrivain en tout cas, sont loin d'être des paradis.
Yeah, we lived a sort of fairly squalid existence, but I think I was lucky. I was lucky in some ways. I was lucky because we were very, very poor. This was in Liverpool in the 1950s and 60s. It was a city which had been a big industrial powerhouse, and it had also been a big naval shipyard, a place where large ships came to unload from America. So it had been very, very prosperous. And in the 60s, all of that was falling apart. All of the shipping had gone to Scotland. All of the factories were closing down. Britain was losing its industrial base. For most of my childhood, my parents were out of work, going from job to job. So we were, it was a fairly desperate existence on that level. But we were, I think we were a fairly cohesive family. We were dysfunctional. We were all over the place. But we loved each other. And our parents were very, very solicitous of us. I think it was kind of midway between heaven and hell, which probably most childhoods are.
Je voudrais terminer avec, fermer un petit peu la page des comics, mais avant de la fermer, je voudrais qu'on parle quand même des X-Men. Vous avez travaillé sur les X-Men, donc pareil, c'est comment est-ce qu'on on bosse sur une série d'une telle ampleur?
I was lucky in that I'd been a fan. I read a lot of Marvel comics in the 60s and 70s. I read all of the original run of X-Men. And I picked up when Claremont brought the X-Men back, when Chris Claremont brought the X-Men back with issue 92, 93. I picked them up again then and read them for many years after that. By the time I came to write X-Men, there was something like 6,000 issues of continuity. Nobody in the world has read all of those. But I picked up bootleg CDs, illegal bootleg CDs that had runs, entire runs of the comics. And I read and I read and I read. And I chose I used two criteria to choose my team. I chose characters that nobody else was using at the time and nobody else seemed to want to use, and characters where I thought, yeah, I could do something interesting with that relationship, with that voice. You know, I felt like I could actually use that character to do some interesting things. So I chose Rogue, who I've always loved, and who has been criminally underused. I chose Mystique, because the Rogue-Mystique relationship is cool and messed up in interesting ways. I chose Sabretooth, because he's, you know, dangerous and off the leash. I just put together this terribly dysfunctional and unstable team, so that you could, you know, when they go into battle, they're kind of battling each other as well as the enemy. So that was what I was aiming to do. There's a cast of thousands in X-Men at this point. You know, at any given time, there's only like a dozen characters who are in the spotlight, and you can choose any of the others and do what you like with them.
On va, dans le même temps, vous allez commencer à publier des romans. Comment est-ce que la transition s'est faite, si c'est une transition? Est-ce que vous continuez à travailler sur les livres en même temps que vous faisiez du comics? Comment ça s'est passé?
It happened because of the comics. Because, as I say, when I was in my 20s, I submitted a lot of novels to publishers and was rejected many times. But I think once you've achieved success in any kind of writing, you can kind of take it and use it as an entry ticket to other kinds of writing. So I went to Orbit, which is a British science fiction imprint. It's actually owned by a French publisher, Hachette. And I said, look, I'm writing this book. It was Hellblazer, John Constantine. I was writing that book at the time. I said, you know, this is a comic I'm writing. I would like to pitch a book series which has a similar flavor. It will feel a little bit like this. So I used the comics as a calling card and as a pitch. And they accepted. They gave me a 3-book deal. And by that time, as I say, having written comics for the best part of 10 years, I was much more confident about structure, and I was much more proficient at structuring a story. Because when you write a comic, the thing about a comic is it's a small canvas, and it's a canvas of an absolutely fixed size. You have 22 pages, or you have 20 pages, or if it's a graphic novel, you have 96 pages, and you can't argue with it. That is your space, and you have to work it entirely within it. And so you become a miser. You think, can I do that scene in 3 pages, or can I squeeze it down to 2? Can I have a splash page here? So it makes you, it forces you to make conscious decisions about structure. Coming out of that into writing novels, novels are easy because the canvas is however big you want it to be.
Et l'absence de visuel, hein, que ce soit pour les personnages ou l'univers, c'est un avantage ou plutôt un défaut?
It forces you to work in a different way. Obviously, when you write a comic, you're part of a team, and the penciler and the inker and the colorist and the letterer are all building that world with you. Whereas when you write a novel, it's just you. It's just you and the reader. I have to confess, I really like that. I like that intimacy, the one-to-one. I love working in comics because if you're working with an artist who you like and trust, you can get some amazing results. But a novel is the most intimate form of storytelling, and that was exciting to me coming out of comics. You know, just building a world entirely by myself. I enjoyed that freedom.
Dans les romans, je voudrais qu'on commence par parler peut-être par votre série, Félix Castor. Comment est-ce que vous avez imaginé ce personnage?
He comes partly from Hellblazer. You know, if you read the first Castor novel, it's quite obvious that Felix and John Constantine share a lot of traits, a lot of qualities. But it's also it came from my childhood. I wrote Felix as basically a version of me in a supernatural world. That's not the right way to put it. He has my childhood. I gave him a lot of my childhood experiences. I gave him a kind of a version of my family. So there are bits of Castor that are autobiographical. I wanted to write a supernatural story that had a kind of internal logic that is kind of more stricter than what you normally come across. It annoys me when I read a novel that has ghosts and demons and werewolves and vampires, and they all have their separate explanations which are not necessarily compatible with each other. So I wanted to write a story where you would have all of those beings, the whole supernatural bestiary, but it would just be one thing, just one explanation. So in the Castor novels, when you die, your spirit survives. And if it survives by itself as a naked spirit, that's what a ghost is. But some ghosts are so terrified of death that they force their way back into their body and they animate it again. So a zombie is just a ghost that won't leave home. And similarly, some ghosts leave their body, or their body is destroyed at the moment of their death, and they have to invade a different body. Animals are easier to invade than humans, so they might invade a dog, say, or a cat. And that's what werewolves are. They're just human souls in animal flesh that are trying to redecorate to make it look more like what they remembered themselves as looking like when they were alive. So all of the supernatural beings in Castor are kind of extrapolations of that one idea. And I guess that was the starting point for it.
Félix, qui est donc un enquêteur surnaturel, comment vous avez travaillé là sur le long terme, puisqu'il y a plusieurs tomes, comment est-ce que vous l'avez construit au fur et à mesure, et comment est-ce qu'il a évolué? Et est-ce que c'est le même travail que sur une série de comics?
No, and I think it's different for the reason that we've already discussed. You know, you were asking me earlier about moving into somebody else's world, and I think This is the weird thing about writing for comics, especially if you write for the American mainstream, that most of your work will be using characters that have already been created and defined by other writers. And part of the job is to sort of feel your way into that imaginative space and stay faithful to it. Whereas with Castor, I was building it from whole cloth. And initially, as I say, I used Hellblazer as a starting point, and I use my own childhood experiences as a starting point. And it's really obvious, if you read the books in sequence, that in the first book, Felix Castor is basically just John Constantine. There's a lot of John Constantine in his DNA. It's not until the second book that he sort of becomes himself. What I liked about Constantine was that he's somebody who is incredibly self-confident and incredibly arrogant. And when he meets gods and angels and demons, he talks back to them. He's cheeky and impertinent to them. He's us. He's us standing up to the forces that try to control us and smacking them in the face. And that's kind of a cool beat to play. And I guess that was the aspect of John that I carried forward into Felix.
Avec celle qui a tous les dons, on va rester dans le fantastique en partie. Est-ce que vous pouvez nous raconter un petit peu, pareil, comment est-ce que l'histoire est née?
No, very, very different. Very different indeed. I'd been through a lot of strange experiences in between Castor and Girl with All the Gifts. The Castor novels did not sell well in Britain. They sold okay. They were selling reasonably enough that my publishers kept accepting them. But they wanted me to do something more mainstream. So they kind of twisted my arm, and I wrote two mainstream thrillers as Adam Blake. They were called The Dead Sea Deception and The Demon Code. And basically they were like Dan Brown. They were like the novels of Dan Brown. It was fun. It was interesting to do. It was a change of pace, but it wasn't me. It was like I was cross-dressing. I was never entirely comfortable writing in that mainstream space. And they were encouraging me to do more books as Adam Blake. And I was pitching stories to them. But in between times, around about that same time, I was asked to do a short story for an American anthology. Charlene Harris, who does True Blood, the Sookie Stackhouse novels, and her friend Tony Kellner do a themed anthology every year, an anthology of supernatural or horror stories with a very, very banal, mundane, everyday theme. So one year the theme was home improvement. Another year the theme was family holidays. And I said I would do a story for one of these anthologies, and the theme was school days. So I thought about it, and for months I didn't have a single idea. Or I did, but they were all sort of like variations on Harry Potter. A supernatural story set in a school. And then one day I woke up with the idea of Melanie, the idea of this little zombie child, this little undead child, writing an essay in a classroom. And the essay is, what I want to do when I grow up. The twist being, of course, that she never will grow up. She'll never be allowed to grow up. I wrote the short story, and it felt really satisfying. I wrote it in 4 days. And for two of those days, I was at a convention like this one in Norway. But I couldn't stop. I just wrote and wrote and wrote, finished the story, sent it in, and it was published as a short story. And I thought, but it isn't a short story. It's the start of a novel. It's the first installment of a bigger story. So my publishers were saying, do some more of this Adam Blake stuff. And I said, no, I won't. I want to do this instead. And I showed them the short story. And they weren't colossally happy because it meant changing the contract. It meant I had to go back to my agent and change my contract, my deal with my agent, because she'd moved from one agency to another. It took a lot of persuading, but that was how I came to be allowed to write the novel. And it's a very different voice, I think. It's something I've never done before, and it worked in a different way than anything else I'd done.
Parlez-nous un petit peu du personnage de Melanie. Comment est-ce que vous la voyez, cette petite fille zombie?
Well, I was talking earlier about the intensity of experience in childhood and the emotional openness of childhood. Melanie is, viewed from one angle, Melanie is a monster. She is a zombie. If she gets close to you and smells your flesh, she will eat you. She won't have any choice in it. Her hunger reflex will kick in, and she will just have to eat you. And then she'll feel terrible about it afterwards. But from another point of view, she is completely innocent. She's an ordinary child. In fact, she's kind of an idealized child. She's somebody who is brave and generous and curious and resourceful. She's the kind of daughter you'd like to have, except for the flesh-eating part. So that was kind of... She was very much the fulcrum, the focal point of the novel, and all of the other characters grew backwards out of my conception of her.
Encore une histoire d'enfance maltraitée, yes. Torturée. Enfin, pas maltraitée, torturée dans le sens... Enfin, si, un petit peu pour Mélanie.
A bit tortured. She's terribly abused. You know, she's been treated very, very badly by the adults around her, even by those who she loves, like her teacher, Miss Justineau. But one of the weird things about childhood is that you kind of accept everything that happens to you and everything that is done to you. You accept it as normal because you have nothing to compare it to, nothing to judge it against. It's only when you get a little bit of distance from your own childhood that you realize that not everybody has had the same experiences as you. So I think Melanie is happy. She loves her teacher. She loves the lessons. She takes all of the weird things that happen on the base takes them very much for granted. But it's a coming of age story. It's the story of somebody making that transition from the innocence and acceptingness of childhood to looking hard at the world and realizing what her place in the world is. And then ultimately taking control of her own destiny.
Une petite question peut-être en dehors du roman pur sur tout ce qui se passe autour de ce livre. Beaucoup de traductions dans différents pays. Il y a aussi un film. Alors peut-être sur les différentes traductions, comment est-ce que vous le vivez? Parce que d'un seul coup, vous avez un livre un petit peu partout dans le monde.
Which is wonderful, and it's been, it's been absolutely amazing watching that happen. My French publishers, La Talente, are based right here in Nantes, and the French translator Nathalie Mege, that's probably not how her name is pronounced, Mege. We worked very closely. She sent me lists of questions. Anything that she wasn't entirely certain of the nuance, she would ask me about it, and we had a long email correspondence as the translation was being done. It's a completely new experience for me. Some of the Casta novels were translated into French, but not all of them. And I've never had a success on this scale. And it's been really interesting because almost all of the foreign translations have used the same cover image, which is, I'm going to fling my arms out. It's an image of Melanie with her arms stretched out wide, either as though she's opening a door or as though she's asking to be cuddled, to be hugged. It's a really powerful image, and almost all of the foreign editions use that same image, and almost all of them have used the same title, The Girl with All the Gifts, Celle qui a tous les dons, which is a literal translation of the Greek name Pandora, because it's partly a retelling of the Pandora legend. The only two exceptions, so in French it's Celle qui a tous les dons, in German it's Die Berufene. Inexplicably, the Italian version is called La ragazza che sapeva troppo, the girl who knew too much, which is meaningless. And the Spanish edition is called Melanie, una novela de zombies, which kind of gives the game away.
Une petite question justement sur l'image de couverture qui est reprise dans tous les pays, et c'est assez étonnant. Comment est-ce que vous avez travaillé?
That was done in-house. That was done by a designer at Orbit, at Little Brown, just one of their design team. And it was actually the second image that they came up with. The first one was just a close-up photograph of Melanie's face. And it was a beautiful, beautiful photograph, really striking. But there is a novel by Cronin, is it Justin Cronin? The Passage, which had exactly the same cover, and we realized it wouldn't do. It would just look like the same book. So they went back to the drawing board and came up with that second image, or with a version of that second image, and we kept on tweaking the color a little bit, and we kept on tweaking the opacity of the figure, because you can see very few details of the figure until we got it right. And actually, I think the French edition uses a slightly different color palette. I think it intensified the yellow a little, but... yeah, that was how it came about.
Parlez-nous du film qui est à venir. Quand on s'est vu en mai, le tournage était en cours. Là, il doit être terminé. Comment ça s'est fait, ça aussi?
That was again just amazing synchronicity, amazing good fortune. I had been talking to a producer, actually a French producer who lives in London, Camille Gattin, and we've been talking about adapting a novel by another writer, a science fiction novel. We thought we had the rights to it, but the rights collapsed. The rights were sold away to a different producer. And so we found ourselves suddenly with nothing to do. And Camille turned to me and said, "Have you got anything else?" And I showed her the short story, Iphigenia, the short story that became Celle qui a tous les dons, because the novel didn't exist at that point. And she was able to get some development money from the British Film Institute, the BFI. So I found myself in the amazing position of writing the novel and the screenplay for the film at the same time, which was amazing. It was really, really energizing. I think it worked to make both versions better, because they're actually very different in some respect. There are some things that are in the novel that aren't in the film, and vice versa. But it's kind of like it's two routes through the same story, and being able to do that was wonderful. And then we went into production, and they began to show the screenplay to actors, and again, just amazing. Glenn Close agreed to be our Caroline Caldwell, who's in a way the villain of the piece, the scientist who wants to dissect Melanie to find out why she is the way she is. Gemma Arterton is Miss Justineau, the teacher who Melanie loves. Paddy Considine, I don't know if you're familiar with him, amazing British actor, is Sergeant Parks, the soldier in the story. And our Melanie, we looked at, we auditioned 400 girls to be Melanie, because she had to be a newcomer. In the story, she's 10 years old. We knew that our actress would probably be about 12 to 14, perhaps, years old. We auditioned 400 girls and found a girl named Senya Nanua, who was a complete newcomer, and she is absolutely awesome. She's a wonderful Melanie.
Quel effet ça vous fait en tant qu'auteur de voir votre film, votre histoire s'incarner comme ça dans le film? En plus, vous avez été sur le tournage.
I don't have any words for it. It was I mentioned Watchmen earlier. I met Dave Gibbons while they were filming the Watchmen movie. I met Dave Gibbons, the artist on Watchmen, in New York, and I said, "What's the film like?" And he said, "It's like they stuck a camera in my ear and filmed the inside of my head." And that's how I felt about Girl. I went up to... They filmed it in the Midlands of England, around Birmingham and Dudley and Stoke-on-Trent, which is an area of Britain that is very, very run down, in the same way as Liverpool is, actually. So there are some very beautiful but very desolate landscapes. And I went up and watched about half of the filming, and it really was just like seeing my own imagination somehow thrown out into the world. It was wonderful.
Et parlez-nous de votre passage sur le tournage.
I was allowed to be in the film, in fact. I'm one of the zombies who gets killed when the army base is overwhelmed about a third of the way into the story. There are thousands of zombies that kind of sweep over the fence, and they die in large numbers, and I'm promised that I will get my head exploded by two bullets, not just one. So I was a zombie. My wife is a zombie. Our three children, my daughter's fiance, my brother-in-law. It was a family thing. The family that is undead together stays together. But apart from that, I got to just sort of be present for a lot of the shooting, a lot of the key scenes, and it was enthralling. I'd never been that close to a movie being made before. There were a lot of things I didn't know about process that I know now. So I think all of that will inform the next screenplay that I write. And it does seem as though having done this once kind of opens the door to doing it again. So the next novel. The novel that comes out in April of next year, Fellside, which is a ghost story set in a prison, has already been optioned for film, and I'm going to be writing the screenplay for that. And then the novel that I haven't even finished yet has already been optioned for film. So it seems that I've sort of accidentally stumbled into this new career, which is nice.
Donc celle qui a tous les dons va être adaptée. Il y a pas mal de gens qui ont travaillé sur cette histoire. Est-ce que c'est encore votre histoire en tant qu'auteur?
Yes, it's still very much my story. I was really lucky. The people I was collaborating with were incredibly, incredibly respectful of the source material. The director is Colin McCarthy. So if any of you watch Sherlock. Or Peaky Blinders, or Doctor Who. He's worked on all of those series. He's one of the most gifted TV directors in the UK, but he had never done a movie before, or rather, he'd done one movie which was very, very low budget. It was called Outcast. It's very good if you can find it, but it's hard to find. So it's kind of like it's my breakout movie, it's his breakout movie, and it was Camille, the producer, it was her breakout movie as well. It was for all of us, it was like our first attempt to work on that stage, to work on that kind of scale. And so we all three of us were intensely involved right from the start. We were kind of a three-headed monster. And I think that means that we all feel a very strong sense of ownership of it. And Colm was able to sort of steer me away from certain things that work well in the novel but would not work in the movie. So between us, we kind of cemented it into a shape that we were all really happy with. And then we stayed very, very, very true to that.
Juste peut-être un tout petit mot, vous avez une nouvelle dans l'anthologie des Utopiales qui s'appelle Visage, nouvelle plutôt de science-fiction, et c'est la confrontation sur un monde qui est colonisé entre quelqu'un qui va juger un petit peu les us et coutumes des gens locaux. Comment est-ce que vous l'avez imaginé et construit?
I have to confess, one of the inspirations for Visage was the change in the law in France about women wearing the veil about Muslim women wearing the veil in public. And I was following the debates about that. I was following both sides of that debate with great interest. And I felt incredibly ambivalent about what was being done, because I could see the very idealistic motives behind the law, but I thought the law was probably a bad mistake, but an understandable mistake. So I kind of just adapted that idea into a science fictional context. So you have like a 19th century British colonial outpost in the Middle East, but with fantasy elements added in, with sort of lots of different non-human races sharing a city with a human colonial power, and the governor of this city is looking on with great disapproval at what he thinks are the barbaric and misogynistic customs of some of these peoples, and he tries to step in and improve the situation, but in a kind of ham-fisted and bullying way, and it has terrible, terrible consequences. So it was me trying to be topical.
On arrive à la fin de cet entretien. Peut-être est-ce que quelqu'un a une question ou deux à poser à Mike Carey. On a 3 minutes devant nous.
Une fois, deux fois, trois fois. Bon, moi j'ai une dernière question. Toute votre œuvre est placée sous le signe de l'imaginaire. Est-ce que c'est parce que vous avez baigné dedans quand vous étiez petit et ado et que c'est une certaine logique ? Ou est-ce que c'est parce que c'est ce qui vous permet de mieux vous exprimer en tant qu'écrivain, de par les thématiques ?
I think when I was a kid in Liverpool reading science fiction and fantasy, it was escapism. I was escaping from a fairly humdrum and black and white sort of life into a more brightly coloured and exciting one. But I think when you start to write in that genre, in the sort of science fictional space or the fantastic space, you realise that it's not about escaping. I think Ursula Le Guin said it best and said it for all time. People who don't read science fiction think it's just about excursions. It's not about excursions. It's about incursions. It's about coming back to the real, coming back to this world, and letting you see it through a different lens.
Mike Carey, on va vous remercier. Vous pouvez le retrouver tout de suite en dédicace, et puis les tables rondes vont continuer. Merci à vous et merci à Mike.
Thank you, Jerome. Thank you for coming.